Okay, let me
Rock and
start
roll.
the recording. Okay, welcome to the Edgar Rice Burroughs podcast, episode 9. My name is Tim DeForest, and I am the author of several books on what I call pre-digital pop culture about the pulp magazines, old-time radio, and such. And I keep a blog called Comics, Old-Time Radio, and Other Cool Stuff, where I also talk about stuff like that. And with me today on the podcast are
Scott Stewart, a freelance writer and editor besides normal work days, and looking forward to the discussion tonight.
And my name is Jess Terrell. You may know me from the Facebook discussion group For the Love of All Things Edgar Rice Burroughs, where Lilla Pop and I discuss Burroughs Pertnere 24/7. We have a good time there. We have a good group. And y'all are welcome to come join us. If I could take a moment here for some shameless promotion, we've got a couple of additional projects now going, Lilla and I do, in addition to the Facebook discussion group, The Love of All Things Edgar Rice Burroughs. One of those is a Facebook page entitled Edgar Rice Burroughs Headline News, managed by yours truly, and it is essentially that. There's a lot going on in the Burroughs world, and this is the big news. The big news items that you as a Burroughs fan need to know. If you consider our Facebook discussion group as a newspaper or as a talk show, well, this is the front page. Headline news is the front page. But by all means, continue to drop by For the Love of All Things Edgar Rice Burroughs. Don't forget us, because there's a lot more going on besides what's on the front page. Another thing is I have been developing a Edgar Rice Burroughs presence on Instagram. During the month of September, I went from less than 100 followers on Instagram, barely using the account, now to over 360. So I'm posting regularly there on Instagram. But the Facebook platform, For the Love of All Things Edgar Rice Burroughs, remains and will remain our main outlet, our main place of spreading the good news and the good cheer. And Instagram is just an extension of that, so to speak. And one more thing, in the terms of new projects, Lilla and I have also started another Facebook discussion group. This began in early August, the same weekend as the headline news, which was fun launching two things at the same time. This new other Facebook group is Everything Zorro. Yes, Zorro, the masked protector of California. With his horse Tornado and his mask and his sword, we are discussing everything Zorro. So by all means, come by and discuss Zorro with us and everything Zorro. All right, Tim?
Yeah, and I just say Zorro is a great character, I've almost, it's just almost kind of too bad that he predates Tarzan by a generation or so. A team up between those two would be really cool. So, okay, but tonight we are talking about Edgar Rice Burroughs' Barsoomian novel, The Mastermind of Mars, the sixth, I believe, in the Mars series, in which it also introduces an important new character to the continuity. This novel was first published in the pulp magazine Amazing Stories Annual Volume 1, which was published in 1927. I found an electronic copy of that online at the Internet Archive, and when I reread it for this podcast, I reread it in its original form. It was a really fun way to do it. That issue had a great cover, an iconic cover by Frank R. Paul, and he also did interior illustrations. It was published as a hardcover book a year later in 1928, and it's had multiple paperback covers with artists such as J. Allen St. John, Roy Krenkel, Robert Abbott, and Frank Frazetta doing covers at different times. So there's a lot of great-looking editions of the paperback out there. And this is just a really fun novel in many ways. And Jess, I believe you were going to summarize the prologue in the first five chapters for us, right?
Yes, I do. And before I get to that, some overall reactions from reading this book. Of course, I love all of Burroughs' works. No question about that, and I want to be clear on that. But I will say that in reading this book, it reminded me a little bit of a Hammer film. Mm-hmm. I kept expecting Peter Cushing or Christopher Lee pop out of the woodwork someplace. It seems that, and all sometimes common in those Hammer films. Rastavis is hanging out with dead bodies every day and thinks nothing of it.
Yeah, but it this, has. I was going to agree with you. It's a very Frankenstein-like horror themes in it, with the mad scientists and the brain transplants and resurrections of people who have been killed.
And Frankenstein there is the key word to segue to my next paragraph. This is a genre of science fiction called uplift. Mm-hmm. And that's where man attempts to play God by creating life or by improving man. You don't hear the word uplift so much, but we certainly know the name Frankenstein, all that entails. Mm-hmm. Also, I would throw in H.G. Wells' Island of Dr. Moreau. And in reading, I think it's a gorgeous biography, Burroughs said that if he had read Dr. Moreau, he probably would not have read Monster Men, not have written Monster Men, one of his own books, which, of course, is another effort in the uplift genre. One thing, recurring thing, is sometimes you see in these uplift stories is once the scientist creates creates life. I just hit my microphone. Once the scientist creates life, he doesn't quite know what to do with it. Thinking about Monster Man, one of the things that struck me, and that's just a different book than the one we're discussing, but the Professor Maxon there had no plans and no idea of what to do with all of his failed experiments. At least Rastavis keeps a big refrigerator handy to put all these failed experiments back. Keeps them on, so to speak.
But Rast has kind of a similarity to some versions of Dr. Frankenstein, especially the way Peter Cushing played him in the Hammer films, where he's doing it just for science without any concern at all about the moral issues concerned. In fact, I could see Cushing playing him, and if this had been made into a movie in the 1950s, you could have cast Peter Cushing as Rastavis. It would have been perfect.
That's a superb point. And actually, reading this motivated me to go back and revisit the Universal films Bride of Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. And Son of Frankenstein has Basil Rathbone in it, who's another fine actor that I greatly admire. And I think he has that Peter Cushing approach, let's say. Mm-hmm. So I would recommend revisiting both those films. They do perspective after reading through this.
Yeah, there's a Dr. Pretorius from Bride of Frankenstein, you could say, is another personality like Rastavis. Is once again, he wants to do the science to prove he can do it, but doesn't care about the moral issues at all.
Exactly. He was the mentor to the Dr. Frankenstein, and the conflict there grows between them until he meets an untimely demise there in Bride of Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. But there are ethical and moral issues to be considered, and perhaps we'll point those out along the way. Getting into the story, this book begins with a framing device. It's a letter from Ulysses Paxton, who was a captain in the U.S. Army during World War I. Letters dated June 8, 1925, so he's been on Barsoom since 1917, so that's roughly, 8 years. Mm-hmm. Paxton had read Princess of Mars and was familiar with John Carter and his ascendants to Barsoom. When Paxton died on a World War I battlefield, he too made the trip to Mars. He describes all this in this letter. And the remainder of the novel is a manuscript that's included with the letter sent to Burroughs. Paxton, in his letter, says he sees Burroughs as the medium through which Earthmen shall become better acquainted with the manners and customs of Barsoom. Now, the thing that I did not pick up on, and if you all saw otherwise, please say so, but exactly how did this letter get to Burroughs? Did it come all the way from Barsoom, or was Paxton on Earth and just dropped it in the mail? Not sure how it got.
Well, by this point, I think Carter, in some of the prologues of the earlier novels, was actually able to teleport back to Earth and visit Burroughs and tell him the latest story. So maybe he just brought it with him as a either that or mail service in the 1920s was really good.
Well, those were similar ideas I came up with. Moving into chapter one, this is entitled The House of the Dead. And here Paxton arrives on Barsoom, and the first thing he sees, first of all, he knows in the prologue that he's died and that he's heading towards Mars. He reached out to us, similar to what John Carter did, and he feels himself drawn to the red planet. So he wakes up on Barsoom, and the first thing he sees is an old, and I'm quoting, an old man who is wrinkled and withered beyond description. His limbs were emaciated. His ribs showed distinctly beneath his shrunken hide. His cranium was large and well-developed, which in conjunction with his wasted limbs and torso lent him the appearance of top heaviness, as though he had a head beyond all proportion to his body, which was, I'm sure, really not the case. Unquote. And we find out this is Rastlevis, who stands perhaps 5 feet five and wears many lens spectacles. Now, let me call up the visual image. If you've not seen it, by all means, go look for it. And I suspect we'll have it included on our video display that accompanies this podcast. And that is the cover of the Amazing Stories Annual by Frank R. Paul that Tim mentioned here in the opening comments. That gives you, I think, a very good visual idea of what Rastlevis looks like. There's also some fine artwork by Joe Jusko, who has that same feel and look to it, yeah, with the many spectacles.
Yeah, the Michael Wiegland cover, I believe, has Rastlevis on the cover as well, and it's another good interpretation.
Very good. We'll have to look around for all of those.
That's one sitting in front of me.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, magnificent. Well, that's confirmed then. Paxton discovers he's in a room that looks like a feudal castle of Europe, but he's actually on Barsoom. Paxton distinguished, he's just arrived, and he knows he's on Barsoom, but that's about it. He's not sure who this guy with the big head and the fancy glasses are. But he distinguishes himself by saving Rastlevis from a dissatisfied customer. That is someone else who'd had a body transfer or brain transfer and just was not happy with it. This guy comes in to kill Rastlevis, and Paxton takes care of it. Paxton then observes Rastlevis perform a human-to-human, and you have to specify these things because it's not always human-to-human, a human-to-human brain and blood transfer. The patients are an old woman and a young woman. Well, more on that later. We will hear more about this young lady later on. Chapter 2 is entitled Preferment. Paxton begins to find his way. He learns the Barsoom language. He learns the name of his caretaker. That's Rastlevis, who's from Tunol. Paxton learns the secrets of transferring blood, which revives old and worn-out body parts. He is given the name Vad Varo, that's V as in Victor, V-A-D, Varo, V also as in Victor, A-R-O. Now, for the rest of my commentary, I'll refer to Ulysses Paxton as Paxton Varo, because, oh, yes, this is one thing I want to point out. Something that I personally do, and I've been doing it for years, and that is, I encourage the reader, first of all, this is a fine story, but I encourage the reader to make a list of names as you go through this, because there are several characters, and some of them have more than one name. So just making a note of that might serve as a quick reference until you get familiar with the story and maybe even jot down the page number where they're introduced or some significant event. I've been doing that for years. It's a very useful tool, and I think it's useful with this story. So, from this point forward, because of the name change from the Earth name Ulysses Paxton to the Barsoomian name Vad Varo, I'll refer to our protagonist and our hero as Paxton Varo. As you've already can tell, there's body swapping and renaming of people underway in this story. Paxton Varo is appointed as Rastlevis' assistant because Paxton Varo is a stranger with nowhere to go and no one to reveal secrets to. He is appointed as Rastlevis' bodyguard and is given weapons. One of the ladies that we saw mentioned earlier, the older lady, the brief mention at the end there of chapter one, is, I pronounce it Zaxa, X-A-X-A. If anyone has a better pronunciation, speak up.
I think that sounds fine.
All right, I'll call her Zaxa then. She is the Jadara, or queen of a hereditary monarch in Fundal, and she's described as, and I didn't say this, I'm reading out of the book, she's described as ignorant, arrogant, and selfish. Mm-hmm. And it was she who received the new young body mentioned there at the end of chapter one. We learned that the young lady who was on the giving end of that body transfer was a prisoner of war who had been preserved for 10 years, and we'll discuss her a little bit later on. In fact, her name is Valadia, and she headlines chapter three. Rastlevis instructs Paxton Varo to restore the young woman's consciousness using Zax's old body. So Valadia, the young consciousness, young woman's consciousness, goes into this old person's body for safekeeping, I suppose. The young woman is horrified at first, but accepts her fate once it is explained to her. She's a good sport about it, all things considered. Paxton Varro is told to observe her psychological adjustment to her new condition. And again, like we were talking about ethical and moral concerns, the physical and medical concerns, there's also psychological concerns. Mm-hmm. This would be enough to drive most people mad. We know the young lady's name is Valadia. She comes from a people who are not friendly to helium and not friendly to John Carter, just making a note of that. Now, there's Paxton, that is Paxton Varro that I'm calling, discusses Brass Savas' work with him. Favis, as we've already noted, feels everything is perfectly justified. What little bad that he thinks he's doing is well justified by all the great good he is doing. And of course, that might be something for a court system to handle, but we're not there yet. One of the previous cases that's kept on in storage down in the refrigerator vault is a half man, half ape. And this is where a portion of a brain of a man was transplanted into an ape body. And you know they have those giant white apes on Barsoom with six limbs. Four of them are arms, and he knows how to use them. And the other portion of the brain was transferred into the other half of the body. So Bad, that is Paxton Varro, has an opportunity to speak with this ape man and makes a pact with him. Now, some details on that. I broke this out, so I'm just not getting that. Rass Savas is talking about the man-ape transfer. I got some details here. Rass Savas explains he transferred half the brain of an ape to the skull of a man after having removed half of his brain, which grafted upon the remaining part of the brain in an ape's skull. This is a direct quote. This is a scientist talking. That was a matter of several years ago, and I've often thought he should like to recall these two subjects. And so he decides to take a look at them. So he knows immediately where they are. He knows the vault. He knows the building number. He rattles the numbers off. So he says to Paxton Varro, come with me, and they'll go take a look. So the man with half an ape brain and the ape with half a human brain, to Paxton Varro confirms, and Rass Savas agrees. So when they woke up, the man with half an ape brain, he was fearful, spoke little, and acted very primitive. In fact, he dragged the corpse off, and they had to subdue him and get the corpse out of his hand. Rass Savas was concerned he's going to damage the corpse. He can't have that. So they put the man with the ape brain away. I'm trying to qualify all these characters very carefully here. Now, the ape with half a human brain, this is the one of interest, at least at the moment. The ape with half a human brain acted human. You could talk to him. He was pretty calm, all things considered. He was a white ape. That is, physically, the body was a white ape. That is, with four arms, two legs. And after examination, the ape, or as Rass Savas says, well, we've seen enough. Let's put him back to sleep. The ape pleads to live and not to be put to sleep. And Paxton Varro does speak up on his behalf. But Rass Savas says, put him away. So then Rass Savas is not somebody you argue with. So, and Paxton Varro even offered to look after the ape, but that request was denied. So Paxton Varro does speak with the ape. As I said, he makes a pact with him and promises to revive the ape at some later point. And this fella, that is the ape with a man's brain, or a portion of the brain, is called Ho Van Du. So make a note of that in your scratch pad that I just recommend. Reading this book, this is Ho Van Du, Hovan space DU. This takes us into chapter 4 called The Compact. We're making agreements right and left here. I hope Paxton Varro is keeping a list of people he's agreeing things with. Paxton Varro learns to do organ transplants. Now, he's under the tutelage of Rass Savas. He's learning quite well. But he does wonder as to why he's being trained. What is the real motivation for this transfer of knowledge? Rass Savas explains that he, Paxton Varro, will transfer Rass Savas's 1,000-year-old mind into a younger body. Furthermore, Rass Savas will arrange for a periodic replacement of worn-out organs and or bodies. This is Rass Savas's way of ensuring do-it-yourself immortality. And Rass Savas really can't do this to his own body. He needs someone else who's just as skilled as he is in order to perform this work, hence Paxton Varro. And one of the reasons Rass Savas, and this amazed me, one of the reasons Rass Savas chose Paxton Varro's because he cannot read Paxton Varro's mind. He can read everybody else's mind. That's what they do on Barsoom, is peek into other people's minds. And when he, Rass Savas, reads other people's minds, he sees that they want to do terrible things to him. So that affects his level of trust in them. He cannot read Paxton Varro's mind because Paxton Varro's from Earth. John Carter has the same ability to have his mind shielded. So he figures if he can't read Paxton Barrow's mind, and Paxton Barrow has no motivation for leaving or doing any harm, then there's nothing for him to fear, and he can count on Paxton Barrow to take care of things and take care of him when Paxton Barrow's performing surgery. Note that, so we've established Rastavis cannot read Paxton Barrow's mind, which is typical of people from Earth. Paxton Barrow can read the assistant's mind, the other people from Barsoom. He can read their mind just fine. But Rastavis keeps his mind closed. He never drops his barriers, and Paxton Barrow cannot get inside there. I'm not sure if you really want to do that, but he's tried and got it in. And as I stated here, and I think it's important to repeat, which is what I do is repeat myself, Rastavis trusts Paxton because he does see hate in other people's minds. And who am I to argue with a thousand-year-old surgeon who transfers bodies? Valadia has an opportunity offered to her by Paxton Barrow to get a younger body, another younger body, not her own. She wants her body, or she wants to keep the old ugly body she's got. Valadia and Paxton Barrow are talking. She describes her life in Duhor, her homeland. She is the daughter of Corsan, the Jeddak of Duhor. Barrow's young ladies typically are princesses, and this is certainly one of them. Her problem started when the ruthless Emporian, Jalhad, wanted to marry her, and he was refused. Jalhad conquered her city, Duhor, and she disguised herself as an ugly woman. When all the captured females were sent from Duhor to Jalhad's home, Amhor. But all those women were designated to be slaves, and Valadia was included in that, and she was sold to Rastavis. Paxton Barrow decides he loves Valadia. He just blurts it out. He's all very happy about it. Despite her aged body, he loves her, and he wants to return her to her home. Paxton Barrow transfers, as requested later on, Paxton Barrow transfers Rastavis' brain to a new body, but, and I do say but, he does get a promise from the scientists to restore Valadia's brain to her original body. Well, Rastavis, of course, points out, well, that's going to cause war and all kinds of unrest. We can't do that. But Rastavis agrees to do it. At least he says he agrees. That's the end of chapter 4. Am I doing okay? Y'all keep
up? I think you're doing great. And so one thing I wanted to comment on here is Paxton wants to go to the city of Tunol and rescue his girlfriend's body. So do you refer to that as a rescue, or is it a kidnapping, or is it a recovery of stolen goods? You know, it's kind of complicated because his girlfriend's actually in suspended animation while he's off, but she's not in the right body. So I guess you call it a rescue. I'm being picky about semantics here. I'm sorry. But
friend, that court system I was talking about, they'd be wrestling with various questions. Yeah. The lawyers, judge, and the jury would all have a big time figuring that one out.
Yeah, is he guilty of kidnapping, or because he's got the permission of the person who owns the body, is it okay? You know, it would be a complicated legal issue, wouldn't it?
It would be. And my first inclination, although it does require great thought, my first inclination, this is a Burroughs story, it must be a kidnapping.
Yes.
But I still have another chapter to do here. I better fulfill my inclination and do chapter 5. That one's entitled Danger, as if there isn't enough going on. So when Rastavis wakes up, he begins chapter 5 as a, quote, new and gorgeous creature. Now, this is old wrinkly scientists we're discussing. He was in a brand new body, described as a new and gorgeous creature. Paxton Barrow overhears that Rastavis plans to kill him and Valadia. Now, this is no mind reading going on here. He heard it said. This is because Paxton Barrow has insisted on Valadia being returned to her own body. So I didn't think I could trust Rastavis, and he said he'd do this willingly. We do meet the personal slave of Rastavis, a fellow named Yandor, and we are told, or we learn pretty quick, not to trust him. So make a note of that. Yandor is not to be trusted. Paxton Barrow hides Valadia in the pits beneath the laboratories, but then he denies knowing her whereabouts. I don't know what happened to her. He sneaks food to her every night, and he's concerned about being followed, but so far, so good. Paxton Barrow sneaks out one night to put her, that's Valadia, in suspended animation. He promises her, and he's making big promises here, that when she awakes, she'll be in her own body again. They hold hands as he presses a button. End of chapter 5.
Yeah, and another thing I think that's neat about these first five chapters is Burroughs takes that long, about a third of the book, to get to the main plot. But it doesn't drag or feel like the plot is slow. There's lots going on. There's lots of information we have to have, but Burroughs gives us that information as a part of the story in an expert fashion, as he always does. These chapters are really a great example of how good a storyteller Burroughs was, because he gets all this complicated exposition in, but still keeps the story itself moving and interesting.
Well said. And I did not go into the level of detail I typically do in these podcasts. I decided I was being too wordy. I think I covered all the main points there.
I think you did quite well, yeah.
Thank you so much.
I think that approach, too, of him setting it up this way, if he'd started off with the main plot of being the chase slash rescue, because I'm thinking of he's rescuing the real person to get to right a wrong of being changed out of bodies there. If he'd started with that and then clued us in gradually through flashbacks, I think considering the exchanges of bodies and names already, it would have been incredibly confusing. So I think this linear approach was the best way to go.
I agree.
One more thing before I turn the microphone over to, I think, Tim, I think you're after me. Mm-hmm. Was talking with one of my group members, Thomas Clancy, who offered several thoughts and ideas regarding the story that we might cover here along the way. Appreciate his thoughts and his time and all of his ideas here. So I just wanted to remind everyone that we need to incorporate that wherever we can.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, you sent me a copy of that, and he makes some really good points. So we should mention them as appropriate. So feel free to jump in any time when one of Thomas's points come up that you think is worthwhile.
Very good. I got in front of me.
One of them I thought, and when he was talking about the names and the religion compared to the science, but one thing that popped in my head rereading some of this after reading the comments from him were Fundel might actually be pronounced Fundel for fundamental, considering that's dealing with a religious entity.
Yeah, that's a good point. And it would be fun if Burroughs did that on purpose. And Burroughs was obviously quite capable of that level of cleverness, so it might have been on purpose.
Well, one thing that I'll toss out here, just food for thought for all of us, listeners certainly, as well as us three, is that Thomas Clancy, one of his points, was seeking the balance between religion, science, and atheism. Mm-hmm. And first of all, to be clear, I recognize everyone's right to believe or not believe whatever they choose. And we are not here, or at least I don't think we want to get into discussing the whys and wherefores of religion and such, but so far as how they run a society, perhaps they're, and I'm suggesting, I'm again not dictating, but suggesting, and I think this is what Thomas was saying, is that they're the proper way to do it for the benefit of all and for the good of all concerned, everyone, and that is to find the balance between religion and science. And we can look back through history and see where things have been out of kilter, and sometimes that hasn't worked out so well. Mm-hmm. So that could perhaps get into the ethical questions that we were raising earlier about, gee whiz, how far should this kind of work be taken in the name of science? And certainly Rastavis may be doing this without people's permission, as we saw with the young lady Valadia. Mm-hmm. That's certainly right. So there needs to be some controls and checks and balances and laws to do this kind of thing properly without hurting anyone. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's good. And I will just mention that very quickly in his depiction of the religion, we're going to be talking about that in more detail in a minute, which is obviously a religion run, a false religion full of absurd legalisms. As a Christian, I just actually agree with the points that he's making. You know, the condemnation of legalism and senseless rituals and all of that is a part of, like, you know, is part of the Bible. So somebody who is religious could read this stuff and has no reason to be offended or even disagree with it, because it's not a sincere religion. And it's not... constructive in the way sincere religions are. And so the Burroughs, the points he makes about legalistic religions that are full of mindless superstitions are very good and very valid to anyone of any religious belief. So, when we get to chapter six, to get back to the summary, it's really this kind of a fun chapter in that Ross Tavis has people following Paxton now because he suspects that he may have stashed the girl away somewhere, and Paxton finds people, some slaves in there who don't like Ross, who are willing to work for him. So he has people spying on the spies, and looking for opportunities to get back to launch his escape and his rescue attempt. So there's a lot of shenanigans going on with the various people allying with various main characters spying on each other that I think makes the chapter a lot of fun in itself. He also starts to put together what I call his ragtag band of misfits, the guys he wants to bring with him to help him rescue Vala's original body. And that is one part of this novel that I think I enjoy a lot. I like what I call ragtag band of misfits stories, where the protagonist has to put together this team of various skilled people kind of on the fly, and they have to use their various skills in specific ways to get the job done. And Burroughs does this really well here. So he revives the body of Gore Havas, which is an assassin who lives in the city of Tunnel, which is one of the two cities they're going to visit during the escape attempt. He's actually an honorable assassin, which is something you can actually be on Mars, in which case you can offer to pay him to kill someone, but he won't take that job if it's a good man or if it's a woman or a child or somebody helpless. And then he'll only kill his target in a fair fight. Burroughs had mentioned before in earlier novels that being an assassin is actually an honorable profession on Mars. And now he kind of gives us an example of an honorable assassin. He's also going to get the help of Dar Terris. This was the guy he actually killed himself at the beginning when he was saving Ross Tavis. But he's a warrior from Fundal, which is where Zaza, who has Vala's body, rules. You really do need flashcards or something to keep track of the characters. When you're reading the story, there's no problem because Burroughs is a great storyteller who explains things well. But talking about it, yeah, you can get lost when you're trying to do a summary. So,
baseball cards with each person.
Yeah, that would actually be great. There needs to be a Edgar Rice Burroughs baseball card set. That would actually be wonderful. The ape with half a human brain, Hovan 2, is going to be the last of the people he's going to revive and bring along with him on the rescue attempt. And he revives them. He explains what he's up to, and for various reasons, they agree to go along with him. So he's now got his ragtag team of misfits to come along with him. In the meantime, Ross shows that his little compound here is surrounded by almost impassable marshes. And the city of Tunnel, which is where Ross originally comes from, is the closest city. And Ross has three small Martian airplanes that he uses to make like supply runs and to pick up bodies and such in Tunnel. So that's a possible escape route. But because the marshes themselves are full of hordes of white apes, and so to try and cross on foot is pretty much suicidal. So in chapter 7, they pull off their escape. They let a small flyer go without anybody on board and let Ross think that they're on board it. And then they hide aboard another ship, a cargo ship with a crew, that's going to Tunnel on a supply run. I'm going through that escape attempt really quick, but it's told with Burroughs' typical skill. It's a very suspenseful scene as they pull off this escape. And they think they've gotten away, but once they're up in the air, they're confronted by Balzac, the captain of the ship, who knew they were there and is holding them at gunpoint. So it seems like the jig is up. But then Balzac proves to be friendly. It turns out that Gore Hodges, the assassin, once declined to kill Balzac's father because his father was a good man. And so Balzac agrees to help them and gets them to Tunnel, and they get off the ship, and they get what Burroughs calls equilibrium motors, which are basically flying belts. So you put them on, and and you're able to fly on a personal level. And one part I like here is that because Paxton is still relatively new to Mars and he's never used one of these things, he can't quite figure out how to work it. And he's going off in wrong directions and flipping upside down and not doing very well with it. They are confronted by a policeman who also has a flying belt, I believe. Gore kills that guy. But Paxton has trouble landing. He ends up in a courtyard somewhere in a garden. And he gets attacked by a Kallet, which is a Martian watchdog, a Barsoomian watchdog. And that brings us actually to the end of Chapter 8. And a couple of things I want to mention here is, one, there seems to be a lot more plant life in this area of Mars than there are in most other places of Mars. Most of Mars is a desert, but here we have one of several places on Mars where there seems to be quite a bit of plant life. Not just the marsh, but the cities seem to have gardens and things like that that you wouldn't expect to find in the the cities located in more arid regions. And so it's just kind of a unique part of Mars that makes it a unique setting within the Martian series that I think just helps give it its own atmosphere, different from the other Martian books. Chapter 9, Paxton is saved from the guard dog by the owner of the person who lives in the house there, Moo Tell. And his friends are also there as well. Because Moo Tell is the nephew of the Jeddak of Tunnel, and the Jeddak is evil, and Moo Tell wants to overthrow him and set up a more just government. And since Gore Hodges is an old friend of his, he's willing to help this group. So Gore has proved useful in several ways. He's also the one who comes up with useful strategic suggestions when they're trying to plan their next move. So each of the persons on Paxton's team are being useful in their own individual ways. So Paxton, his skin is stained red, so he looks like a Martian. They're all given weapons, and they're going to dress up as Panthons, which is a Martian soldier of fortune, and they're going to pretend that Huvandu, the half-human ape, is a trained ape. So they're going to be displaying him as doing tricks and stuff, which would be their cover story, because Moo Tell is going to give them a ship to get to Fundal, which is the city where Zaza with the wrong body lives. We're once again running into a case where we really need those baseball cards in order to tell who's who. And once again, I do want to stress that reading the story, you have no trouble keeping track, because that's Burroughs' skill as a storyteller. Just trying to do a summary, it's easy to get lost in all the characters here, I think.
Yeah, this story is much, much better than I made it sound. I can certainly say that.
Yeah.
not commenting on your commentary.
No.
But it is a well-written story.
It is. Also, it's while they're in Tunnel that Burroughs starts getting a little philosophical, because Tunnel is a society where everybody wants to be completely rational, not react to emotion at all, and they're an atheistic society as well, because they see religion as irrational. And this is what balances the view we get of Fundal, where they're insanely fundamentalist about a superstitious religion, and where Thomas's comments about the balance there is, because Burroughs is obviously critical of the complete atheism of Tunnel, and he's also critical of the absurd fundamentalism of Fundal, and so he is arguing, I think, for a balance there, and we see the beginnings of that when they're in Tunnel, and Paxton learns about their outlook, no emotion, no religion, anything, and Paxton and Burroughs himself are obviously being critical of that. So he's setting up his philosophical points during this chapter. But he doesn't stint on the action. While they're taking the boat to Fundal, they get attacked by a Tunnel patrol boat. And there's an absolutely wonderful scene where Hova Du, the ape, and Paxton board that ship and kill two of the six guys aboard it. And the ape is kind of a morale destroyer for the rest of the crew who surrenders. But it turns out they are friendly as well when they find out about Gor Hodge. The guy is extremely popular. He's kind of a celebrity. And everybody likes him, and he keeps running into people in Tunnel who are willing to help them. They agree to give them a lift in their boat all the way to Fundal and drop them off there. They do make sure that they're not planning anything against their home city, so they're not being unpatriotic. But they're just saying, after that, we like you guys, we like Gor Tavis, so we're going to help you. We're going to take you there. So Chapter 9 ends with them getting their trip to Fundal, where they need to be to capture Zaza with and get that body back to Roz Tavis and get the brains back in the right bodies. I really do enjoy that action sequence as well. In the original Amazing Stories annual, there's Frank L. Paul's, one of his interior illustrations, and it's absolutely wonderful illustration of that scene. And it's just a short but really effective action scene. And I do want to say, though, that the crew of that boat, they were very kind of just, okay, whatever, about the fact that Paxton and Hovantud had killed two of their friends before taking over the boat. They didn't seem to worry about that otherwise. But I guess that's a part of Martian culture. If you die honorably in battle, you're not going to get mad at the guy who did it, because that's just what you do on Mars. So Chapter 10, they get to Fundal. They land unobserved. They have supper. They go to the Temple of Tur, which is the god of Fundal, and this is where the religious rites, the fundamentalist superstitious religious rites, are very much parodied by Burroughs in this, and so he's balancing out what we found in Tunnel, and that's his philosophy of the two extremes by themselves are damaging and harmful. So you need a middle ground there somewhere. That's obviously the point that Burroughs is trying to make. I think Thomas caught exactly what Burroughs was trying to do when he made those remarks that he sent you. And Hovan Du is the man ape. He performs in front of palace guards. And their plan is hopefully to get an audience with Zaza, the queen, because to show her Hovan Du's tricks. And that works. The guards say, hey, I think the queen might get a kick out of this. Why don't you guys go inside? So at the end of Chapter 10, they've gotten inside the palace, where they eventually have to get to Zaza and figure out a way to kidnap her and get away with her in order to get Vala's body, brain, back into that body. And that is Chapter 10. It's great action stuff. Burroughs puts the philosophical points he's making into the story without ever interfering with the pacing or slowing the story down. It's just another example of how skilled a storyteller he was. Any comments on these sections from you guys?
I would clarify, perhaps, when we use the word criticism, we are not saying that Burroughs is saying that such and such religion is bad. But I think, at least the way I see it, is he's teaching us to ask questions. He's teaching us to say, is this really a good idea? What is it based on? And does it make sense? And is it right for us?
Right. And the rituals shouldn't just be blind rituals. They should serve a purpose, and that purpose should be explained to people.
Exactly. He's trying to make us think and to ask questions. That's what, when we say criticism, and by all means, correct me if you think otherwise. Mm-hmm. But when we say criticism, he's posing questions to make us think.
Yeah. I agree completely with that.
All right, very good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's something else. Before we move on, there's something else I wanted to comment on from the earlier in the book. Most of Mars, before John Connor got there, worshipped the goddess Isis. And if a Martian was lucky enough to live to 1,000 years old, they went down the river, was it the river Iss, the river Dis?
The River Is.
Yeah, River Is, and you never saw him again. So people, because Martians seem to be immortal, you weren't necessarily, you know, you didn't see any old people there, because chances are, because Mars is Mars, you would have died violently before you got to 1,000 years old. But if you did get to 1,000, you did that pilgrimage. In this area,
went down the river because they felt like it.
Yeah.
It wasn't like because they were in poor health. They just thought it was time to go. Whatever triggered that.
Exactly. But here in an area where they obviously never were, that religion by this point had been discredited, but they obviously never worshipped Isis here. Tunal was atheistic, and Fundal worships the goddess Tur, the god Tur. So you have two examples in Ras Tavas and in Zaza that shows that Martians, it takes more than 1,000 years, but eventually you do start getting old. So I think this is is this the first time we see a truly old person? Was the atmosphere plant guardian in the first novel described as old? I can't remember.
Well, not as old. He may have been older.
Mm-hmm.
Confirm that. But he not as older appearing as Ras Tavas appears.
Yeah.
As Ras Tavas.
Yeah, so here we get an indication that Martians are not completely immortal if they don't die violently. They do eventually get old, and Ross was worried about his organs failing. So it is possible to die of old age on Mars. You just have to wait a really long time to get there.
Sorry. Burroughs says that the lifespan is right about a thousand years.
Okay.
Now whether Barsoomian years or Earth years, I'd have to look it up. But 1,000 years is a long time. How you measure?
Yeah, it is. So okay. Well, Scott, you were going to summarize the last few chapters for us.
Sure. Coming up on chapter 11, as you said, they're getting ready to enter into the palace and bring their show in. When they are allowed in, they are brought in by several guides who bring them through a kind of a maze of different hallways and stuff. And they suspect they're being brought this way so that they'll be confused on what direction where they're going through on this route. Gradually, they come to the room, and Zaza is there, and she has them basically arrested or taken prisoner. Now, for brief moments, I'll call them Paxton Burroughs like you did, or, you know, they call them Van, too. But they think about fighting back. But he is believing if they're going to be able to get through their mission, they're as far in as they're going to get at this point without being hurt or having to fight their way back in. So they decide to give up their arms and allow themselves to be captured so they're at least within the palace and work from there. During this time, then, she says that they are to be taken to... First, she questions him and knows who he is. They've actually been given a warning by Roz. She has been given a warning by him that they may show up and may be there to thwart both their plans with the body and brain transfers. So when she does question them, she's at first surprised that Paxton Burroughs doesn't deny who he is. And then she asks where Dar is, because Dar had already left the group. He says he does not know that Dar didn't come because he was worried about his own safety and own life. Like that. And she orders them into the pit that to be taken guard and put them into one of their pits or dungeons till they decide exactly, I'm sure, how she wants to exact sacrifice or life or execution of them. At this point, Paxton Burroughs has been whispering in the ear of
Hovind Du.
The White Ape, I'm sorry. Yeah. Trying to remember the name.
Hovind Du,
right?
Yeah.
Hovind Du, yeah. again, Jess, this is one time I wish I'd done what you were saying about going through the book and putting the names down.
Well, you'll remember, I double-checked that name before we got started.
yes. And I think we maybe need to talk to Christopher Carey or somebody they need to authorize baseball cards for every Burroughs book so you can get collections of them with all the characters from every book.
Yeah, I would recommend, and we can talk about this off air, that I presume we're going to do a video montage. I could put together a list of characters to be included there, if that'd be okay.
That would be fine. I think that would be great.
Yeah. All right, I'll do that.
And I'll just say real quick that if the Burroughs Incorporated did put out baseball cards of the characters, I would throw my money at that.
So, I would too.
So.
So anyway, Hovind. Hovind Du makes a break for it to the window. There's a open window, and he goes up that way, and he's just flailing. He, you know, has that strength. He's a great white ape, throwing the people around, and then really gets their attention. And let me read this here, because this is really good, if I can. Oh, yeah. They just know that there's this trained ape bouncing everyone around, and they treat him as a wild animal. At one point, he turns around, and then he goes because of his half-human brain. "I go," he cried, "but let harm befall my friends, and I shall return and tear the heart from Zaza. Tell her that. Tell her that from the great ape of Tarth." Now they're really freaking out. And this is a good time for Paxton Burroughs with Gore to take off. And the great ape has, white apes, has escaped through the window. And they are now running through different hallways to make their way out of their palace, while the guards and soldiers and everyone else tries to get over this. "Whoa, wait a minute, we just didn't get beat up, a lot of us, by this ape, but he talked to us." And they give chase, and they end up going several stories up through the palace as opposed to down, because they're afraid that's where everyone will look for them first, trying to escape on the bottom floor. And as they make their way up, they end up in a hallway that they close the door on, because other doors they've tried have been locked, and they hear a voice. "Who's that?" Well, two of the, I'll call them priests or monks, for the god that they follow, Tur, is they are farther down the hall, and they hear the noise. They go, "Who's that?" Well, now both Gore and Paxton Burroughs try to hide in the shadows against a wall so they can't be seen. And they're trying to press themselves far back and hope that they don't come walking down the hall and come across them. And as they do, Paxton Burroughs is up against the wall and finds these rocks or jewels. He feels one is loose, and when his hand's rolling around it, it slides open the door. So he grabs Gore, and they get inside this door and close it. So when the priests come down, they open the door that they just come through. And when they see that, before they open, they said, "Who's at the door? Who wants in?" And they're identified as guards on the other side. They said, "We're looking for the prisoners." They say, "Well, there's no one in here. We haven't seen anyone here. We've been here quite a while." So the guards keep on going, and now no one thinks they're in that area, and the priests walk on down the hall. In the meantime, Gore and Paxton Hughes find out that they're actually in a room that is inside the huge idol or statue of Tur. And as they're looking around, they see there's a skeleton on the floor that they surmise had fallen from above, maybe 30 feet, and cracked his head and died there. And the bones are dusty and old, been there for years and years and years. Then Paxton Burroughs also finds that there are some controls in here. Think of the Wizard of Oz.
that's a beautiful analogy. I love that.
being behind the curtain, and they're able to do controls. that will make people come there. But we will learn that the statue has not spoken in a very, 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 very long time, 100 years or 400 years. That's been ancient history, which was probably, I'm thinking, the skeleton fell there and no one else knew about the place in there. This will come into play because as they're hiding in there have been there for a while, the doors to the sanctuary open up and Zaza comes in with her troop of servants and slaves and warriors, and they actually have Tarsus with them, and they had found him wherever he was wandering outside, and they brought him in, and they are going to make a sacrifice of him. Well, now this coming up part reminds me of more than the Wizard of Oz. What came to my mind was the Disney movie Lieutenant Robin Crusoe with Dick Van Dyke on the island where he's inside the cave area of another statue of an idol for the natives. So what they do is she starts the ceremony is he first turns on controls that rolls and moves the eyes around. So the people are out in this sanctuary look up, and suddenly after hundreds of years, the eyes are rolling down and looking at all of them and then rolling back up. And they're scared. And he also, there's a speak piece, voice piece that he's able to use. You know, and, I'm Dor and I'm angry and you have not given me the proper respect. And he says, do as I say or else. And has a plan. He says, extinguish all light. And so they put out all the lights. And at that point, Gore goes down and takes Dar Taurus back into the hidden area with them. But when the lights come on, he'd also left the skull that's there. And so now the statue is speaking to them by Pax and Burles. See, I have taken him, and I will take whoever I want. Now they're getting very, very scared, and he says, I showed myself to you as a great white ape, and you did not know me. And I'm thinking some scripture references there. I came and you didn't recognize me, God. You know, and I'm wandering around among you, so watch out. And they say, everyone must leave except Zaza, for I will take care of her personally. Well, they make no short work of heading out the doors and getting out of there. And she tries to leave them too. And a bunch of the people grab her and throw her back down by the sacrificial table because they don't want to get killed by him. So after they've left and the chamber's completely gone, they retrieve her and take her prisoner. So now they've got her to bring back and hopefully exchange the bodies and the minds where they need to. Let's probably spend a little more time than I need on that part, but I love that whole scene where he takes control. Any comments on that?
It's both hysterically funny. It's honestly suspenseful. It moves the plot along in a way that makes sense in context of the story. It shows that Zaza was an evil queen because her people just throw her under the bus as soon as they need to. And it just works on all those levels. And, of course, he's using their own superstitions against them, which is further makes his philosophical point of condemning that sort of irrational superstition.
Exactly. Oh, well said. I think that these people are so afraid mm-hmm. of that statue, which represents their god, that they're not going to go near it. That's why over all these 100 or 400 years, they've not examined it to see if there was a door there. And to see, gee, where is that strange smell coming from, which was a dead body inside there? They just weren't going to go near it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of the things I forgot to mention, we're actually in chapter 12 now. it guides in there so easily on the storytelling. So that the part with the chapter 12 great tour is actually the scene in there where he's playing the pranks on him. After discovering the controls he has in there. But one of the things that I also found interesting is when Zaza comes in, they show her coming down in a chariot that's guided and pulled by Banths, or the lions they have on Mars, on Barsoom. The lions are being guided, if I remember right, like by leashes or whatever, by trainers, probably. They've probably been raised for this. But the idea that, and she's laying on a chariot, that the middle aisle coming into this sanctuary room with the idol statue, the statue must have been very huge, because she's coming in a chariot pulled by these large Barsoomian lions. It had to be a very huge auditorium or sanctuary for the people to fit in there in the years when they probably used it even more, and whoever may have spoke through the statue to them. It has to be a huge place. And I'm guessing when those eyes rolled and the voices came and the flickering of the lights, because we're not sure exactly how brightly lit it was, had to be a very intimidating place for most people.
It must have been, yeah. This scene makes me wish that Cecil B. DeMille had once directed a Burroughs movie, because the spectacle, the spectacle would have been that huge, and he would have been the perfect director for it.
So. If this was made into a movie, I would be living for the scene of Chapter 12.
Mm-hmm.
It was great. So in this part, when everything, when they have her now, they do manage to escape. They find a flyer, they get in the flyer, and they head back to Favus there to get back to do the transfers. The Sagor is, not Sagor, I'm sorry. Hovindu? I just keep on throwing that name out. Is with them, and he's able to talk to the great apes when they're there trying to find a place to hide the ship. And the great apes said, we will let you go in and do that, but we want you to unlock the front gate at some point before you leave, so that we're able to get into the fortress, which they agreed to do. So most of the group is now dropped off into the fortress during night. It's very quiet. These flyers have maybe they're going on like one blade, very slowly and quiet propeller to move them along and fly in without making a noise. This time the night is either dark because of clouds or the moon's not shining, so they're not seeing and dropping that off. Then they go back over and they open up the gate, or they've unlocked it so that the other two can come in and get into the palace. And they lock, I'm surprised they lock it again there, because they have to, well, this is probably giving away when we're talking about the plot anyway. They have to fight and get back out there to open it up again to let the great apes, the white apes, come in.
Yeah,
but part of that would also be they don't want to be, they need the time, they need a couple days to get into the lab and switch to bodies. Was someone was going to say something?
I was actually going to make that point, that I don't think they could at that point, because they needed time to do all the brain swapping before they could afford to let all the apes in.
And I agree that would be part of the, plus it gives part of the chase back for his action writing later on, that he is afraid, Paxton Burroughs is afraid of finding out that Val Dea may have been discovered, but he does find her body where he put it and brings it back, and without jungling up all the names, the things going on, everybody gets returned back, the brains back to their bodies.
Right.
And even though there's some contention on whether or not Zaza should be brought back or revived along with her high priest or bodyguard. They said they promised they weren't there to kill him. They just wanted to return the brains back. But they decide to leave the White Ape on Revive. But everyone is back now into their brains and bodies. And during this time, and we're in Chapter 13, back to Thavis now.
Yeah,
I also have Paxton Burroughs come up with an idea on what he thinks can help resolve this even more instead of just letting everyone go free. They end up fighting and being discovered on the way out, fighting to get out. They do get the gate open, and the White Apes come in, and they have at it. They escape into the flyer, and then they get back and basically get into we'll be going into Chapter 14, which is called John Carter at the end.
Yeah.
But during this point, the heroes, people have to sneak, trying to sneak back into the palace. They are discovered, but now Val is able to, or Vala is able to pretend she's Zaz at this point. So they let everyone go through there. She invites the people and nobles to come now to say that there is going to be an explanation of all that has happened, and she has spent all this time with Tur, and the god Tur has now released her to tell them what they want. Then they have this huge procession that goes back into the table. During this point, Paxton Burroughs has already gone back into the stone idol again so that he's able to talk and do the whole thing of bringing down lights, bringing up lights, that type of thing. And he comes off and says that Tor, that he is very angry. My people have disobeyed me and have done things against my will and tried to do things that are wrong instead of right. He says, and part of this way is I am going to return everyone's bodies and brains back the way they're supposed to be, because the people there don't know this has gone on, and they switch with no one seeing it when the lights are put out. The real Zaza, who is now back in her body when they've returned, shows up along with
Dar Taras is back in his own body, and it's hard to keep track of. And I will once again say, when you're reading this, we're having difficulty summarizing it because there's so many different characters with names which are odd. When you're reading this, everything is clearly explained. A reader has no trouble following the story, and when he's reading Burroughs prose.
Yeah, that's why I kind of wanted to try and stay away from so many names at this end here, because they do that. But Dar Taras is back into his old body. And Paxton Burroughs as Tor, as the god, says, as you have heard, Zaza has given up her crown. And she's like, she's awake now, and she's like, no, I didn't, in her old body, and everyone's looking at her. She goes, and she like has a stroke, has a apoplexy, and and dies at the foot there. And now everyone is really like, okay, what's going on? And he says that Dar Tarsus is now the Jeddak. He is now the leader. You will take your orders from him. He is appointed there by me. So then we have that exchange of power going on. The people are accepting of it. As was noted earlier, the people have no great love. The guards, the priests have no great love for Zaza. So in a way, I think they find this as a relief and consider him, Dar Taras, to at least be a strong leader, general, a fair or more honest person. They're willing to go with him. Also during this time now, of course, Paxton Burroughs is back with Vala, and they're happy about that, and they're going to end up leaving the area there and going back to her home area too. During this time, another ship, Barsoomian ship, comes up, and they want to talk to Zaza. And they tell them, well, Zaza is no longer there, and Dar Taras is there. And says, he goes, Dar Taras am here. He says, I will speak with you one of two ways. Either you are here in peace, and I will talk to you, or if you are here in war, we will bring our arms up to you. Now, it's a ship carrying John Carter, and they have come to either make war or peace, but they want to talk to resolve things. And this is where John Carter makes his appearance. And then they raise up a flag showing they want peace, and they do it on another ship, two flying ships next to each other and talk. This is like on the last page, page and a half or so, last page of the story there. It wraps up real quick. Dar and Kara, who he's been looking for, his loved one, are married. I'm going to say Vod, but Pax and Burles with Valadia are married back in her kingdom. And he finds out that not just a princess, her father is the warlord or the king, however you want to put it, Jeddak, the head of that entire area. So he is heaped on with treasures and honors for rescuing her and getting married there. And incidentally, John Carter was part of the festivities there. And everyone is happy and everyone is good. And life goes on.
Essentially the all the cities involved, including Vala's home city, by the end of the story, all the evil rulers have been overthrown. So just essentially everybody in the area gets a happy ending, except maybe Roz Tavis, who's allowed to continue his work, but he now has to pay more attention to ethical considerations.
And one thing, I never read I read some of Mars books. Mm-hmm. As I got them, as opposed to having all of them in a store bookshelf in my little town ready to read. And so I read them slightly out of order. This was one of the earlier ones I first went to. And I was caught off guard and was a little put off at first that this was one I think I started where John Carter wasn't like in it. Well, he's mentioned letter, which I love the opening letter and the way they just put it in there now. Mm-hmm. And this is who I am. This is my story. I know who you are because of John Carter, but he doesn't show up until the last 150 sentences or whatever like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of like, no, this is the Mars books. This is Mars who? John Carter is like the Batman, the Superman. He should be in every one of these books. But, you know, so... At first, at that age, 9, 10, I don't know, 12, something like that, I was like, well, wait a minute, the real hero isn't here. You know what, there was a real hero in the story, was a blast. It also proved that Burles, as a world maker, wasn't tied into, you had to have the same character and you see this in some other books, in every book when we talked about Chessmen of Mars. There are so many other characters that are the prime focus of the storytelling. As I was younger, I wanted John Carter, because if I buy a Superman comic or Batman comic or Spider-Man, that's who I want in it. But as a world builder, he was able to build this world in the different lives and societies and give them each a segment, not just two or three paragraphs of one chapter in a book. Because I've read some books, you know, that are 800 pages long, and they're sectioned into 100 pages on this character or 200 pages on this world and these characters. And sometimes I find that disconcerting, broken up like this. Here you've got each individual book showing what that vast society and world is. And that's, I think he did it. I'm sure we're all agreement, a marvelous job.
Yeah. He does the same in Pellucidor, where it's David Innes in the first few books, and then he expands that to highlight different characters in different novels. I agree. That's an aspect of his skill as a world builder, to know that a world, a huge, you know, as big as Mars or as big as Pellucidor, would have a lot of variety in it, and he takes advantage of that as a storyteller.
And I'd like to jump in and simply echo what you all were saying about the presence of Ulysses Paxton in this book, mm-hmm. and of course the other. The variety of heroes, not only in the Barsoom novels, but also in the Pellucidor and some of the other books, where it's not always the Tarzans or the John Carters of the world who is our protagonist, it's somebody else. And that's what I like.
Yeah.
And that's something I would encourage in a grand grand scheme library like this, or a huge stories like this, because having those different characters like Ulysses Paxton, or one of my favorites, Von Horstover and Plucidor, or Tara of Helium, for example, those different characters bring a different perspective. Mm-hmm. They're a little different than the mainstream, a little different than the John Carter, a little different than the Tarzan. They have different motivations. They have different skill sets. They have different ways of approaching problems. And that adds, I think, variety for the reader. It keeps them off guard just a little bit. And you avoid falling into the routine of, well, you know that the hero is going to do such and such to resolve that issue, because we've seen it through four books now. So you know he's going to pull out his rope, pull out his knife, pull out his sword, whatever it is, and take care of that situation. But here, we don't know Ulysses Paxton so well, so we don't know exactly what he's going to do. He's bringing in the perspective and the recent experience of being a World War I soldier. That's a little different, mm-hmm. a little than what John Carter brought to the Barsoom novels. A little different.
Yeah.
Seems a little more analytical.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And it highlights something. I don't think Burroughs always gets enough credit for how good he was at characterizations and the variety of characters he included in his novels, including amongst his protagonists. So,
one other point I wanted to make for anyone who hasn't read it or will read it, too, is that Ross is still alive. And in order to regain his area and stuff, he now makes a pledge that he will use his medical or scientific knowledge for the good of people and not do the experiments he's been doing.
Yeah, I don't know if he keeps that promise, though. Like, three books later, he's making genetically engineered monsters, from another lab. He runs off somewhere and starts up his shenanigans again. So,
yeah, this little turncoat moment here, I guess.
Vet room number four almost takes over the world. A couple of points I would like to jump in with, if I may. I'm really reading from Thomas Clancy's notes to us. And again, thanks to Thomas Clancy for raising these points. And I probably have been more appropriate if I brought them up a little bit earlier, but I didn't want to interrupt anybody. One thing here that Thomas points out is the name Tur, T-U-R, which is Rut, spelled backwards, R-U-T. Okay. And perhaps that's just a way of pointing out how the rut, shall we say, these people are in with their religion and their statues and such. But I think that was an interesting point, and it could be more of that fun down type humor that Burroughs might have thrown in there. Mm-hmm. Another thing was that, another point here that Thomas makes is we've already discussed the body swapping, the brain swapping, and the name swapping going on in this story. And then here we have Bad Varro speaking through pretending to be a statue. So that's another kind of the god Tur. That's another kind of swap going on. And then Thomas also points out, and this is in the Ace paperback, page 112. The phrase "God-given" is God is spelled with a lower case G, and that's not typically how it's spelled. I did some checking on that, but it's spelled with lowercase G in the Ace paperback, and in every version I checked, ERB Ink edition, the hardcover, page 227, the Ballantine paperback, page 118. It's in chapter 11, and with chapter 11 being titled Zaxa XAXA, so it's in there. But the phrase "God given opportunity" is lowercase, and there was some speculation if that was intended to be in lowercase to make sure that every interpretation of God was included in that statement. So I think perhaps that's what was meant. I'm speculating, mm-hmm. mind you, mm-hmm. that might be what that means. So those are things that Thomas pointed out. And again, thanks to him for providing these thoughts. Okay, I'm done.
Thank you, Thomas, yeah. for hearing this. Thank you. We really appreciate you bringing in some extra commentary.
Yeah, I love Thomas's points, and I do appreciate his efforts as well. It was really, really nice of him to do that. I will comment, though, one other time I can think of Burroughs dealing with religious issues is some musings that Tarzan made. I'm almost certain it was in Tarzan at the Earth Core, where he didn't go into any detail at all, but Tarzan was musing about the existence of God and deciding in his own mind that God must exist. And he wasn't going into any sort of theological depth with that, but he was acknowledging a higher spiritual power. Tarzan was, and how much of that was reflecting Burroughs' own belief, I have no idea. I have the feeling it was, but so he's not being disrespectful at any point to the people who believe in God or have religious belief. He's simply criticizing and parroting extreme irrational fundamentalism, which is a perfectly legitimate thing to do.
Those questions and some of that discussion occurs in one of the Jungle Tales, for sure.
It does, yeah. He has a chapter, isn't it, where he's trying to figure out what God is.
Right? Exactly. He also discussed this, who made Hissa the snake.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. I forgot. So that's at least two other examples involving Tarzan. So, and there's one other thing I'd like to comment about the character of Vala, who's a great character, and you can easily see why Paxton falls in love with her. But I was kind of comparing her to Terra of Helium from The Chessmen of Mars, which was the book just before this one. Terra was a great character and a brave, good person, but she had character growth during the story. She was kind of stuck up, and she had to learn not to be stuck up. And she was a main character throughout the whole. In this one, Vala spends the big chunk of the story in suspended animation. And I think that was because she was already like the perfect girl, and she had no room for character growth. So in addition to the plot requirement to have her in suspended animation, I think that Burroughs might have gotten her out of the way because he couldn't do the same sort of character growth with her that he was able to do with Terra in the previous novel. That's just a presumption on my part. But she didn't need character growth. She was already a fantastic person. And so that's one reason that Burroughs constructed the story so that she was out of the spotlight for most of it.
Something happened to her body too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. While they're on this adventure or journey, then he would lose her because the brain was there.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. No, there was a practical reason for it. It makes sense in terms of the story. But I was just thinking that maybe Burroughs constructed the story in such a way where it made sense for her to be out of the spotlight. So because there was no real character growth to do with her. He couldn't do the same amount of fun with her character that he could have that he did with Terra of Helium. Just an idea.
I think it's a great point. In my opinion, a story ought to have a character growth for somebody. It doesn't have to be the hero or the villain or whomever. If someone in there should... I think story is better if someone, some kind of an epiphany or demonstrates that they've learned something or made some kind of decision you wouldn't think they were going to do first off.
So, okay. And I think we're coming to the end of our discussion of The Mastermind of Mars. It's just really is a really fun book. And very, very notable and very unique for a Burroughs book in many ways. The hammer horror theme that you mentioned early is one of the reasons that makes it as unique as it is, and Burroughs really handles that well. And so that's it for now. We are recording this at the end of September in 2019. I've actually found my own Valadia. I'm getting married in 3 weeks, a little less than 3 weeks. So
congratulations.
Thank you. And so we may not. I can't promise we'll be able to do another one until the next calendar year. So we maybe have a bit of a gap before there's another podcast. We need to talk about actually what we want to do next in the duration anyway. But if either of you have a chance to record a little mini podcast like I did a few weeks ago, you could send me an MP3 of it and I would post it. And I may have time to do a mini podcast of my own. You can find that on the podcast website or on the YouTube channel. I talk about the various cool pets in the Burroughs universe. So if we can get in some mini podcasts in the meantime, that would be great. But there is some obscure requirement about my paying attention to my wife after I'm married. So we may have to wait until January before we talk about scheduling another one. I will keep in touch with you guys about that.
You think the code will be January?
Yeah. By January she'll be Angela may be used to me enough where if if she can get an hour alone while I'm doing a podcast, she might be perfectly happy to do that. But it may be sooner. We just have to play it by ear. So, but I'll be in touch with you guys, and we'll talk about what we want to do next, and we will be, still be doing these podcasts. We appreciate, we get anywhere from 300 to over 1,000 hits on any individual podcast, and so we appreciate the people who are listening, and we will be back again soon. Once again, my name is Tim DeForest. Please visit my blog, Comics, Old Time Radio, and Other Cool Stuff. And buy my books and make me wealthy beyond the dreams of avarice. And do you guys have any more plugs you want to do before we sign off?
Jess, go ahead. I don't. I just want people to read Burroughs' books.
Mm-hmm. If you're inviting me to speak, I'm sure I can find something to say. Let me begin with inviting everyone to drop by Facebook discussion group where Little Papa and I discuss Burroughs pert near 24/7. That's for the love of all things Edgar Rice Burroughs. If you're on the go or in the need to know, be sure to drop by the Edgar Rice Burroughs headline news page. And if you're looking for a diversion and another fun place to visit, that's Everything Zorro, all on Facebook. And as stated previously, I'm doing Instagram too. That's ERB_fan. And I discovered, I don't have my notes, and if you can't find the Instagram account, send me a message or say something in my Facebook group, and I'll get you pointed to it. All right, that's it for me.
Okay, thank you again, and we'll be back again soon with another podcast.